Wear the velvet underwear. No. No. Change it. Velvet underground. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Lyrics for Lunch, the show that thinks it's James Dean for a day. That's the line, right?
And she had to crash.
Yeah. This is the podcast that brings you the unforgettable stories from some of your favorite songs and artists, stories you can't unhear no matter how hard you try. I am Aviv Rubenstein. I am one of your hosts. Joining me as always, I know I remember this time that she likes me to say her name, Lindsay Tucker. How are you doing this week, Lindsay?
Great. How are you?
Great. I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in there, as they say.
Okay.
Another day, another dollar, as they say. How are you this week, Lindsay?
I am great.
Well, great. I'm happy for you.
Selling it.
You're selling it. What are we talking about today, Lindsay?
Today, we are talking about Walk on the Wild Side from Lou Reed.
Not the Velvet Underground, just Lou Reed.
Correct.
Great.
Louis Allen Reed was born. On March 2nd, 1942 in Brooklyn.
Okay. Love it.
Son of Sidney Reed. I like the name Sidney. For either anyone. I like androgynous names.
Yes. Sidney Reed sounds pretty Jewy.
Maybe. He was a tax accountant.
Whoa.
He was a tax accountant. And Toby Reed, a homemaker.
Toby, another androgynous name.
Correct. Wasn't sure who was going to be who until I saw the homemaker.
Yeah, but it's interesting, especially like the song that we're dealing with doesn't not deal with androgyny.
True. You excited?
I'm so excited. This is one of those songs that I think was on our like very original list when we were coming up with the ideas for this show.
I think
that this is like very early on and we're kind of just getting back to it. But yeah, I have been interested in learning about the song for a while.
Okay, he's born in Brooklyn. Then when he's 11, his family moves to Freeport, Long Island.
Okay, cool.
The long and the short of it is that when he was a kid, his parents felt like he was antisocial. He was very anxious. He would like hide in his room to avoid meeting people.
Okay.
Totally normal, if you ask me.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, like, sometimes, like, that is a sign of abuse, like one of the warning signs is if they don't want to like see an uncle that they should want to see or whatever. But yeah. Seems like he was just kind of shy.
His sister said he had panic attacks, social phobias. He possessed a fragile temperament. His hyper focus on the things he liked led him to music, and it was there that he found himself. However, his parents were at a loss with how to deal with the situation and like enrolled him in some electroshock therapy and experimental psychiatric stuff.
Cool. I'm sure that had no effect on his later career at all.
Yeah, well.
It's weird because it seems like he just might have like a spectrum disorder and they're just like, let's put some voltage through that brain of yours.
Yeah, and I feel like mental health is still stigmatized widely. Yeah. It's like just getting like less so, but there was so many misdiagnoses and like literally people lobotomized for no fucking reason.
But only women. See, Lou's not a woman, so he's not at risk of being lobotomized.
Because interestingly, his doctor said that he had schizophrenia because his mom didn't pick him up enough as an infant. So everything is always women's fault.
Yeah, this is also like the classic 60s, like I was hugged not enough or too much.
Yeah, so his sister said that was a burden that she took to her grave.
Oh, Jesus.
All right, so yeah, we got off kind of on a interesting start.
Poor Toby.
Anyway, all of that seemed like he had a pretty traumatic childhood. He did have a breakdown in early college, but then after that, I think he just kind of turned to self-medication.
Never a problem. Has never gone wrong in the history of music.
But he, you know, also channeled his angst into his music.
Sure. Yeah.
According to the New York Times, after transferring to Syracuse University, from New York University, where he only went for a year, I believe. So then he transfers to Syracuse and he fell into the inner circle of the poet and short story writer Delmore Schwartz, which was one of his English professors.
Okay. It's weird. It's weird that one of your professors has like an inner circle, but go on.
I know. I was just about to say he starts hanging out with his teacher. Always a good sign. This is from the New York Times. Reed would later resist being pigeonholed, but his college profile suggests a distinct type, an early 60s East Coast hipster, a middle-class suburban rebel in love with pre-Beatles rock and roll, jazz, and street life writers. William S. Burroughs, Hubert Selby Jr., Raymond Chandler, and Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, it feels like he would probably be wearing a black turtleneck at this time.
Totally.
Yeah. And snapping. Instead of clapping at things, they would snap. That's Lou at this time.
So after graduation, he found work in New York as a staff songwriter for Pickwick International, which was a label that capitalized in trends in popular music with budget releases by made-up groups.
Okay. What a wild thing.
So I'm imagining like the Monkees kind of thing.
Yeah.
But not on television.
It's probably closer to like, have you seen Inside Llewyn Davis?
Mm-mm.
So in that, that's about like a folk artist a la Bob Dylan, but before Bob Dylan, and Justin Timberlake, your favorite person, is like a studio musician.
What do we call my favorite person?
Yeah. No one denies this. hires Llewyn to be like a session guitarist for like a novelty song called Please, Mr. Kennedy, Don't Shoot Me Into Outer Space.
Please, Mr. Kennedy, I don't want to go.
Don't shoot me into outer space.
How have I not seen this?
It's really, it's a very, very good movie. It's like a frustrating movie, but a good movie. And that record winds up being, spoilers for the movie, that record winds up being quite popular, even though they don't get credit for the, like, being on it because it's like a fake band. It's made up of session musicians.
So we think it's like that.
I think it's kind of like
Pickwick that. International.
Just even the name sounds. So Pickwick International was a record label. And their whole thing was like bargain bin sound alikes. So like they would, if like the Monkees were popular or if the, you know, whatever's the Birds were popular, they would do like a Birds knockoff song to try to capitalize on that success. It's a real Transmorphers situation.
Well, among his credits for Pickwick were Johnny Won't Surf No More and The Ostrich, written for a non-existent dance craze and sung by Reed himself.
Yeah, Johnny Won't Surf No More sounds like a Beach Boys knockoff, right?
She had fun till
Johnny can't surf. Yeah, can't surf no more. Exactly. By the way, the company that makes those Transmorphers movies is called The Asylum. And so they do like budget versions of blockbusters with similar titles, hoping that people will get confused and accidentally buy or rent their version. And they've been sued so many times. Their legal department is bigger than their production department.
Oh, I bet. Wow.
It's crazy.
That sounds fun.
To work
Russian
for the Asylum.
Roulette. No, yeah. Of like picking a movie out of a hat, but it's all those.
All the Asylum films. They yeah. are so bad.
When Reed met Welsh musician John Cale, who was working with Lamonty Young's Theater of Eternal Music, they wanted to combine early 1960s rock with classical minimalism.
And their decision to implement early 1960s rock wasn't a throwback because they were in the early 1960s at the time, right?
Yes.
That's the
and
idea.
And Reed like loved rock forever until he died.
Sure. Spoilers.
Whoops. Yeah, so they jammed with guitarist Sterling Morrison, who was a Syracuse friend of Reed's, and poet and visual artist Angus McLeese. I Googled how to pronounce McLeese because I didn't know, and it was like McClesher. And I don't know if that was right, you guys.
McClesher. Okay. McLeese is okay for me.
Okay, so, you know, Angus. He was one of the original members of Velvet Underground.
Add the
As was Cale. So Cale played viola, keyboards, and electric bass, and they named themselves, as we have said, the Velvet Underground, after the title of a book by Michael Lee on practices in non-standard sexuality in the early 1960s.
Oh, so it's like a reference to, like, the underground sex people and their velvet dungeons or whatever?
Knickers.
Knickers. Okay, sure. The velvet, we're the Velvet Underwear. No.
No.
Change it. Velvet Underground.
It sounds
better. That's very cool. I didn't know or remember that John Cale was in the Velvet Underground, and I have read the Please Kill Me book, so I probably should have remembered that or known it.
Should have. So you can see, though, from the beginning, the theme of non-standard sexuality is a driving force behind their musical identity and Reed's musical identity.
And the blurring of music and other mediums of art.
Yeah.
Right. Because all of them are like visual artists and poets as well as musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And Reed, I watched an interview with him where he was saying, like, in the early days of rock, you only needed to know like three chords, and I was super lucky. So, you know, I think you've talked about that before, how it was easier to become a musician back then.
Yeah. The story that I tell about the MC5 is from the book that I had just referenced, Please Kill Me, where the MC5 had a group of dudes in Detroit who had just started telling people that they were in a band.
Oh, yeah.
and couldn't play, didn't have any songs, couldn't play any instruments, but they were like walking around to pick up impressed women. They would tell people that they were in a band, and then they got a phone call from someone asking if they wanted to open for the Velvet Underground. Because
so
they had heard that there was this band,
band
in
out
Detroit.
There.
Yeah, so yes, it was a very different time.
And so the Velvet Underground sort of combined influences, rock, and like this avant-garde,
mm-hmm.
experimental sound, alternative, just saying genres now, but...
Proto-punk, like, just weird... Not run-of-the-mill rock. Because, like, pre-Beatles, rock and roll was, like, you know, Heartbreak Hotel. It was, like, very, very standard songs of, like, my baby's driving in my 57 Cadillac, windows down, like, super, super rote, standardized kind of songs. No real innovation.
Yeah. Hence the three chords. Maybe.
At least from the whites.
Yeah. So maybe it's not surprising that they did not immediately find commercial success, even though they became one of the most influential bands in music history, really, if you ask the snobs.
Yes. I can't remember who said the quote, but it's like, I think we've said this on the show before. The Velvet Underground only sold 10,000 records, but every person that bought one started a band.
Yeah, I did see that quote.
Yeah.
It might even be in my notes somewhere.
Yeah, I don't remember who said it, but it's like one of those like very famous quotes about
rock and roll. I think I have that down there. So they formed in, I think I said 1964, and they disintegrated in 1971.
Not that long. 7 years.
A year later, Reed releases Transformer, a single or a solo album with songs like Perfect Day, which I'm sure you know.
Incredible song. Really, really great song.
Wait, I guess it's about heroin. Is that mm-hmm. true? We should look it up for our show.
There is a... it seems like there are many songs about heroin.
Sure. But isn't spending it with you? Is the you the heroine?
I believe that is at least the myth around the song. I don't know whether it's true.
Fact check. Fact check it one day.
Some commentators have seen the lyrics as subtext displaying Reed's romanticized attitude toward a period of his own addiction to heroin. But this was like kind of the urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was included, because of this urban legend, it was included in the soundtrack for Trainspotting, which is a movie about heroin addicts. And so that like added fuel to that fire is like now, you know, everyone just thinks it's about heroin.
Got it.
But it doesn't seem like there's like a smoking gun on the surface that it's specifically about. That the U in the song is Lady H.
Well, good. Makes me feel a little better. Okay, so perhaps most notably on this album is Walk on the Wild Side. I think it's the most notable Lou Reed song, but Perfect Day is up there.
Walk on the Wild Side, I think, gets played on the radio more often.
Okay, so Walk on the Wild Side was produced by David Bowie and Bowie's Ziggy-era guitarist, Mick Ronson.
Sick.
What do you like about the song?
I don't know. I don't know what I like about the song. It is one of those songs, like we were talking about with Fast Car, where it has just been around my entire life, and it has just, like, existed. So I can't remember the first time I ever heard it, but it was, like, a cool, catchy, easy to listen to, not easy listening, but easy to listen to song, and the hook is very cute, right? Do 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 do. Yeah, just super catchy, I guess.
Great. So people remember it for its catchy melody, as if you cleverly
pointed
it out.
I'm people.
Its iconic bass line.
Yes. And the bass line is also very, very good.
Which has only been sampled a couple times.
Yes. A couple million times.
And its bold lyrical content, which explored themes of gender identity, sexuality, and the underground culture of New York City, all of which were really taboo topics, especially during the 1970s.
That came to me a little later. Like, I knew the song before I listened to the lyrics of the song, and that became, like, something that was whispered about in, you know, in cool kid circles. Is like, oh, this song is about, you know, a trans woman and that kind of thing.
Okay, so let's listen to the song.
Yeah. Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked away across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side.
The song is also Candy famous for just being two chords out on the island. The whole time.
In the back room, she was everybody's darling. But she never lost her head, even when she was given head. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go do 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 do. Little Joe never once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey Joe.
So there are actually two basses in this song. There's one doing the iconic bass line, and then there's one that's kind of like walking, which is an upright bass, which I never really
Sugar
noticed.
Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the streets, looking for soul food and a place to eat. Went to the Apollo, he You should have seen them go, go, go. They said, hey, sugar, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. All right. Ha. Jackie is just speeding away. Thought she was Jim Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that fast. I said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doot, 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 doot.
It's interesting that this became a radio hit.
I agree. Super unlikely. It's like kind of jazzy toward the end.
So now you've had a listen.
So now I've had a listen.
What yeah. The song is about.
So this is definitely a story song, and it feels like a bunch of women coming to New York and like meeting kind of grim, finding like something grim waiting for them there. For like someone who listens to lyrics like me, I don't really know the lyrics of the song that well, even though I've heard it maybe 10,000 times. Like, I know the lyrics to Lola way better, which is like a similar, has like similar subject matter.
Yeah. Lola is about Candy Darling.
Lola's about the same person as one of these people. No shit.
Yeah.
Fuck.
So
mind blower.
Let's do a quick lyric read, and then we'll talk about the lyrics.
No, it's Lou Reed. Holly came from Miami, FLA, hitchhiked her way across the USA, plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Nice, respecting pronouns. Said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side.
Candy came from out on the island. In the back room, she was everybody's darling. But she never lost her head, even when she was giving head. She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side.
And the colored girls go, do, 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 do. Not great. Little Joe never once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City's the place where they said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. So Little Joe is a prostitute, which I
like
never realized.
Never realized.
Yeah. A sex worker. We don't say hookers anymore. Said, hey, Joe, take a walk on the wild side.
Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the streets looking for soul food and a place to eat. Went to the Apollo. You should have seen them. Go, go, go. They said, hey, sugar, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. All right.
Jackie is just speeding away. She thought she was James Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that bash. Not what I thought the lyrics were. Said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, do, 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 do. Saxophone solo. Incredible.
All right. So the lyrics for, any thoughts, or should I just talk?
I didn't realize how direct the lyrics were. I didn't remember that he was a she is the end of the first verse. And I didn't realize how very explicit the lyrics were for a song that we kind of whispered about and puzzled over in high school. Like, if we had just read them, read the lyrics, it would be like extremely clear what the story's about.
So the lyrics for Walk on the Wild Side were inspired by Nelson Algren's 1956 novel, A Walk on the Wild Side.
Mm-hmm.
And this depicted, quote, downtrodden prostitutes, bootleggers, and hustlers of Perdido Street in the old French Quarter of 1930s New Orleans.
I guarantee.
Says Goodreads. A Walk on the Wild Side found a place in the imagination of all the generations that have followed since. As the writer admitted, it wasn't written until long after it had been walked. I found my way to the streets on the other side of the Southern Pacific Station, where the big jukes were singing something called Walking the Wild Side of Life. I've stayed pretty much on that side of the curb ever since. The book asks why lost people sometimes develop into greater human beings than those who have never been lost in their whole lives. Why men who have suffered at the hands of other men are the natural believers in humanity, while those whose part has been simply to acquire, to take all and give nothing, are the most contemptuous of mankind.
This is interesting because this feels like a combination of two of those very stereotypical literary books, Catcher in the Rye and On the Road, which is like of this, you know, Beat generation or whatever, On the Road. And this seems like a much better rendition of the story than like either of those books, which I don't particularly care for. I just think it's interesting that like those two books are referenced constantly and we like have to hear about them in English classes in high school. And I've never heard of this book before.
That's because the curriculum was basically the fucking Constitution. We can't change it.
Correct. And probably there's like more sex and drug use in this than in either of those other ones, which we have to be shielded from lest we, you know, not like
become
we were
groomed by our teachers.
Yeah, groomed by our teachers. Groomed by our teachers to be gay. My students don't listen to me when I tell them to send me a PDF. You think they're going to listen to me when I say be gay?
You're very convincing.
I am pretty convincing. Hey, kids. Be gay. Be
gay.
Do
you like violence?
Do crimes.
So another thing I thought was interesting, though, was the book is takes place in New Orleans. The song mm-hmm. takes place in New York, but we still have that kind of like jazzy saxophone that you could.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you could imagine it on the streets of New York, but I feel like more at home in New Orleans.
Yeah. That's a good call, a good pull. Is like that is the street corner that the especially because it just kind of fades out, so it feels like almost spatially like you're walking away from this corner that you've been hanging out on watching these sex workers, you know, do their evening strolls.
Yeah. So Reed originally set out to create a musical adaptation of the novel,
but
eventually for some reason or another that project just disintegrated and he started writing the song instead. So with this inspiration, he infused the lyrics with real-life characters that he'd encountered at pop artist Andy Warhol's underground New York studio, The Factory.
Andy Warhol was very instrumental in the Velvet Underground's like performance art shit. And I think the banana record cover mm-hmm. is like yeah. an Andy Warhol record
it is.
Cover.
Yeah. It is. The Velvet Underground's relationship with Warhol started in 1965 and it evolved through the years into the band's incorporation in his multi-sensory productions, Andy Warhol, Uptight, and Exploding Plastic Inevitable.
Right.
He produced them and at one time he was noted as their manager. He secured studio time for their first album at Skeptor Studios in New York. In April 1966, the Velvet Underground recorded their songs unsigned to a record label and without executive oversight, which allowed them greater creative freedom.
For sure.
And Warhol encouraged the band, you know, stay true to your own sound, explore, you know, just exploring.
Do you know a lot about Andy Warhol?
I mean, as much as anyone else.
Yeah, I wonder if he was like independently wealthy. Because it seems like, I mean, he did get very famous and made a lot of money off of his art, but this has the energy of like a trust fund kid who just like can afford to be weird. And I was wondering if you knew whether he like came from money and had that like safety net for himself.
So I actually don't know that. What I did read was that his first New York studio was $160 a month. It was like in an old abandoned fire station that mm-hmm. no one wanted. I think it was, you know, an unsafe place to be or deemed that.
Sure.
And so they took over this. He took over the studio. It was $160 a month. He around the same time sold his first big piece for like $20,000 or something and then used the money from his
sales
to fund the factory. However, it does seem like it's very difficult to break out into like pop art and sell art for that kind of money. So
especially back then, that's like an order of magnitude bigger now. It's like $200,000 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That's just something I will look up on my own time.
We'll talk a bit more about Andy Warhol in the next couple of minutes because that's what my notes are.
Sure.
So the Velvet Underground and Nico with that iconic banana peel cover was released March 1967.
Yes. And Nico was the husky voiced singer of songs like These Days, which is not Velvet Underground. I think it's just Nico, but you would recognize from the Royal Tenenbaums.
I was just going to say that. Yes. Yeah. Royal Tenenbaums, the bus stop, bus station.
Yeah. One of the best single shots in any movie.
So this is from Art News. It may be hard to recall a time when the Velvet Underground and Nico was unpopular, but in fact there was one, and it was 1967, the year it came out. While the record is now considered a towering achievement, its aggressive sounds and subversive lyrics now seen as precursors to so many sonic trends afterward, the Velvet Underground and Nico did not find a mass audience at the time. Behind the scenes, Warhol was influential in the creation of the album, serving as the band's manager. Warhol was the one who linked up the Velvet Underground with Nico. The musicians ended up taking part in Warhol's Exploding Plastic Inedible performances, yet even Warhol's involvement did little to boost the band's commercial prospects. So we've heard a little bit about the factory.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about what the factory is?
That was kind of just their like art collective, right? Was it in that firehouse that you were talking about?
They moved from the firehouse shortly thereafter, and the next studio became the factory.
Okay. I just knew it as their studio, yeah.
Yeah. Andy Warhol's studio in New York City had four locations between 1963 and 1987. The factory became famed for its parties in the 60s. It was the hip hangout spot for artists, musicians, celebrities, and the Warhol superstars, which we'll be talking about. The original factory was often referred to as the Silver Factory, which I'll tell you why in a minute.
Oh, I was like, because of his hair?
In the studio, Warhol's workers would make silk screens and lithographs under his direction. So, yeah, this is where he found the old unoccupied firehouse on East 87th Street in 1963. No one was eager to be there. The rent was $150 a month. And then a few months later, they were told the building had to be vacated. So they found another loft on the fifth floor at East 47th Street in Midtown, which would become the first factory.
Mm-hmm.
So John Cale said, quote, "It wasn't called the factory for nothing. It was where the assembly line for the silk screens happened. While one person was making a silk screen, somebody else would be filming a screen test. Every day, something new." In 1963, artist Ray Johnson took Warhol to a haircutting party at Billy Name's apartment.
This sounds like an old New York lady name dropping stuff. We were at Billy Name's apartment and it was a haircutting party.
So I Googled, I'm going to sound, if people know what haircutting party is, let me know, because it's in quotes half the time you read it, and then sometimes it's not, and then when you Google it, it's
exactly
like not
what it
a thing.
Sounds.
Like,
yeah.
It has to be, I think it has to be hair. Yeah. So, so there's this party, it's at Billy Name's apartment, and he had covered his apartment with tinfoil and silver paint. Everything from the ceiling, the pipes, the toilet, the refrigerator, even the silverware was painted silver. And Warhol loved this and asked Billy Name to do his studio.
So it was like a space egg. They were like inside of some kind of space microwave.
Yeah.
Okay.
No one could track their brains or whatever.
Yeah,
the tinfoil hat's supposed to do.
Can't put metal in the science oven.
So that's when the silver era of the factory was born. And just a little like last tidbit on Billy Name is that he eventually became the factory's spokesperson, caretaker, lighting designer, technician, official photographer, and its only permanent resident. He's not name dropped in the Wild Side, but that's Billy Name.
So he was like the Guillermo of the group, where he's just doing all the work and everyone else is like lounging around on drugs.
Smoking. So aside from the prints and the paintings, Warhol produced shoes, films, sculptures, commissioned work in various genres to brand and sell items with his name. So not two brands.
Warhol,
his first
Warhol
commissions
brand cereal.
His first commissions consisted of a single silkscreen portrait for $25,000 with
Jesus
additional canvases
Christ.
And other colors for $5,000 each. He later increased the price of alternative colors to $20,000 each and used a portion of this to finance a factory.
I'm not, I don't want to downplay Andy Warhol's contribution to art, but it also kind of feels like right place, right time.
Yeah.
Where he's like, here's a can of soup, and everyone's like, brilliant.
Amazing. I know.
6 zeros on my check.
Okay, so when asked to describe Walk on the Wild Side, Lou Reed said, "I thought it would be fun to introduce people you see at parties but don't dare to approach." So these are the parties he's going to.
Holly, Candy, Little Joe, Sugar Plum Fairy, Jackie.
So Reed introduced listeners to a cast of characters who represent various aspects of the marginalized and unconventional lives that were part of New York's subculture at the time, says American Songwriter. And we can vouch for that.
Correct.
So let's meet them, the characters.
Yes.
Okay. We'll start with Holly.
Holly came from Miami, FLA.
Hitchhiked her way across the USA.
Are we doing it? I was just reading the lyrics again.
I had them here, but. We just did them. So she plucked her eyebrows, she shaved her legs, he was a she, and she said, "Hey, babe."
Right. Respect Holly's pronouns. I just keep bringing that up because the song is like 60 years old, and Lou Reed gets it better than the people who are younger than him, you motherfuckers.
Well, also, everyone in the circle respected the pronouns. When you can watch videos, interviews of them all hanging out, talking, and... the pronouns were very respected.
Not that hard, people.
Okay, so Holly Woodlawn was a real person, a transgender actress. I just don't like actress because, like, that's a gender thing. But
yeah. So now, now people are just using actor as like a gender neutral term, but a transgendered woman actor, right?
And a Warhol superstar. Yeah,
right on.
So who are the Warhol superstars?
They were just like the people that were regulars at the factory who then became the stars of a lot of the Warhol films, which were like super weird and experimental. There's one called Blowjob that I have seen, which is just a single frame of a person getting a blowjob, like of their face for... 8 hours or like he would like
eight
play
hours.
It for like he would play it for like extended periods of time. There's one called Sleep, which I've also seen, which is just footage of someone sleeping. So yeah, the cast of characters that he would use in his films were these Warhol superstar people. Films and also like other pieces of art. I'm
right.
More interested in the film stuff because of who I am.
Right. And he famously had said, like, in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes.
He sure did say that.
And this was kind of his embodiment of that idea. He would film them, name them superstars. They were part of his entourage. They're the Warhol superstars.
Oh, interesting. It's interesting. So he's like bestowing, he's the one that gets to bestow Holly's 15 minutes on her by virtue of like who he is.
Kind of.
Yeah, it's interesting. That is like a different angle for me to look at that. In the future, everyone will have 15 minutes of fame, parentheses, and I will be the one to give it to them. Right? Like, I will bestow this fame upon everyone for a period of 15 minutes because I am Andy Warhol.
Back to Holly. So Holly was featured in Paul Morrissey's film Trash.
Mm-hmm.
Her debut acting performance allegedly amazed director George Cukor.
Cukor, yeah.
Who tried to get her an Academy Award nomination for the role, but that never materialized.
Yeah, and George Cukor did like a Philadelphia Story, or the Philadelphia Story in Gaslight. George Cukor was from the previous generation, which is interesting that he was in this scene, right? Because the Philadelphia Story came out in 1940. And so it's interesting that he's like in his 70s at this point being like, that's the star. That's the person that needs the Academy Award. That rips.
Yep. So the first verse of Walk on the Wild Side was dedicated to Holly's journey from Florida to New York, where she did flee. She left Florida so she could be herself in New York City.
Right. She left oppression in Florida.
Yes.
Who would have thought? I'm glad things have changed.
In her memoir, she wrote, at the age of 16, when most kids were cramming for trigonometry exams, I was turning tricks, living off the streets, and wondering when my next meal was coming.
That's so sad.
We're going to hear from Holly. This is from the 2004 documentary Superstar in a House Dress.
It was a major incident where I went to the bank as a French ambassador's wife and got away with $2,000 and, you know, spent a month in jail. In Variety magazine, there was a big banner. Trash star found in trash can. The warden comes up to me and says, oh, is this you? And there's a picture of me in the New York Times saying, Hollywood loan, fabulous and trash. And he says, you are now out on bail. I said, who bailed me out? It was Larry Rivers. And he said, Jackie Curtis. Curtis called me up and said, you got to get Holly out of jail. If it wasn't for Jackie, I would have been in jail for God knows how long. Andy didn't come to my rescue. My parents didn't even come to my rescue. And Jackie called up everyone and said, you can't let Holly rot in jail. Her movie just opened. Jackie said, you know, we're going to take you out to see Trash tonight. And I was a mess. I was in jail for 30 days. So Larry took us to Bloomingdale's and said, girls, go shopping. And we did. So I went and bought a fabulous dress. And Jackie's, she bought a fabulous, you know, house dress. What did she do? She just rips the shit out of it.
Hell yeah.
She takes her stockings and goes, ow, oh, there's, you know. I'm going, Jackie, what are you doing? She goes, it's a look, isn't it? Okay.
So the Jackie that she is referring to is Jackie is just speeding away, Jackie.
Correct.
Cool.
Jackie Curtis. All right. Who's up next?
Now we have Candy came from out on the island. I'm assuming that's Long Island or Staten Island.
Actually not sure which island Candy came from. This is referring to Candy Darling, another transgender actor and Warhol superstar. This is the one who was in the back room, everybody's darling, and she went by Candy Darling and sometimes Candy Warhol. Reed had sung about Candy before. She was the Candy who said, I've come to hate my body and all that it requires in this life on the third Velvet Underground album in 1968.
Oh my God, what a fucking brutal thing to say in a song.
And then, as I told you earlier, Lola by the Kinks. And the Rolling Stones' Citadel. Is also both tributes to Candy.
Holy shit. Is she still alive?
I don't think any of these.
No, she died in 74. She died young.
So Reed had said that he originally feared the reaction of his characters to Walk on the Wild Side, but he later recalled, quote, Candy Darling told me they'd memorized all the songs and wanted to make a Candy Darling Sings Lou Reed album. It probably wouldn't sell more than 100 copies. that was, quote, Candy. So Candy was also a Warhol superstar and appeared in 1968's Flesh and then Women in Revolt, which came out in 1971.
Yeah, so that's also Paul Morrissey. Flesh, Trash, and Women in Revolt are all the same director.
Mm-hmm. Who yeah. was in the Warhol entourage.
Great.
And she was in other films too, but it was a brief career because she died of lymphoma at age 29 in 1974.
Holy shit. Talk about like burning bright, but short.
Yeah. So this is a clip of Candy and Andy Warhol. And earlier in the scene, I don't think we're going to encounter them, but Jane Fonda is there. It's just a bunch of people hanging out, I think, on a film set.
Warhol's studio, called The Factory, is on Union Square. We called there, no result. He was at a farewell party for Jane Fonda on the SS France.
We're doing a picture together. Candy, darling.
Well, we're calling you Lana and a Bum Trip.
Jane Fonda is going to be in Warhol's next movie. At least she thought so. Warhol did not.
I hope. In Hollywood?
Oh, I guess so, yeah.
Who is certainly going to be in it is Warhol's newly discovered star, Candy.
I call myself Candy Warhol now. Cashing in. Take my hat off. No, Andy came into a luncheonette where I was working as a waitress. And he came over to me and said, you should be in movies.
With them
eyes. Yeah.
The luncheonette was like 6 in the morning, and it was called Paradise Heaven or something. No, what was it called?
It was.
Oh, I know. Oh, it was 12th of Always.
10th of Always. 10th of Always.
So tell us about the film. What's the film about?
It's called Blonde and a Bum Trip.
Are there any marbles?
What's it about?
It's about a naive young lady who goes to Hollywood to make it big.
Candy is a man, but in Warhol's phrase, she's a real lady.
I'm the new girl in town. And I meet Rita Hayworth, Jane Fonda, Lana Turner, Kim Novak, all the glamour girls. And I interview them and cut them apart. And then at the end of the film, I'm murdered, I think.
Very cool entourage. Jane Fonda was wanted to distance herself from her movie star father, and so hung out with the counterculture.
And here is the clip, quick little clip of Candy in Flesh.
Ooh.
Now look at my hair.
I like it.
It's terrible.
I like it.
Do you believe this hair comb costs $10? $10.
But you can do it yourself.
Andre did it. Andre of Paris on Fifth Avenue.
Why don't you do it yourself? It's so easy.
I'll kill that queen, Andre.
You just don't comb it.
Well, I don't like a set look. You know? I don't like anything that looks too set. I like things a little
wrinkled.
And things that move.
So the interesting thing about this is Candy's having like a conversation with someone, but you're only looking at Candy. You never cut to the other person that she's talking to.
Mm-hmm.
It's still moves.
Super avant-garde kind of filmmaking style.
Sounds like a child. Right?
Oh, don't.
Yeah, I think that they're just like way off mic. That's what you sound like when you're not talking to your mic.
Oh, don't.
You have the like super high voice, the mid-Atlantic accent.
When they, all those beautiful statues, that they don't have big tits like a cow. They're all willowy.
Yes, but if one of those statues did it, it would stand out.
Let me see what your bust looks like.
Weird.
Yeah. Okay.
Fun fact, according to the American Songwriter, radio stations happily played the uncensored explicit version of Walk on the Wild Side that said references Candy giving head.
Giving head, yeah.
Because they didn't know what it meant.
Right on. Happily. Okay.
Losers.
Stupid. Fucking losers. Open a book.
Yep. Okay, who's up next?
Little Joe never once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. Hustle here, hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey, babe. So the operative word is hustle. A hustler is a term for a male sex worker who services older, not only women, but the implication is like older women, like American, or what's it called? American Gigolo or Midnight Cowboy is a movie where John Voight plays a hustler. It is famous for Dustin Hoffman banging on the hood of a cab and saying, hey, I'm walking here, which was improvised. And he mostly services women. And then there's like some implications that his sexuality might not be all the way on the all the way to one end of the Kinsey scale. Midnight Cowboy also happens to hold the distinction of the only X-rated film to ever win Best Picture.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was before NC-17 existed. No NC-17 picture has ever won Best Picture either, but Midnight Cowboy.
What about Showgirls?
Showgirls did not win Best Picture. Just narrowly missed out on it. When you were showing me the clips of, especially the clip of Candy Darling talking about, like, hitchhiking to LA, going to Hollywood and like interviewing all of these glamour girls or whatever, that reminds me of the plot of Showgirls. Like, I think that Showgirls is kind of, I have like a weird appraisal of that movie, but I think it's like kind of this brilliant Warhol-esque satire more than it is like a shitty movie where a lot of people are naked.
Yeah.
I think it's more Hitchcocky and Warholian than people give it credit for. I actually like Showgirls.
Yes, it says a hustle here, a hustle there. However, Little Joe is not actually a hustler.
Ooh, twist.
The reference is to Joe D'Alessandro, who is an actor, and this is referencing one of his roles in Flesh, his role in Flesh.
Oh, where does he play like a hustler in Flesh? Yes. I see, okay.
So
don't get it twisted. Joe's not actually a hustler.
But Joe is
male presenting.
Male presenting and an icon of gay subculture and a male sex symbol of underground cinema.
Cool.
And we're going to see a little clip of him in Flesh in
1968. Great.
You straight? And nobody's straight. What's straight?
It's
not
straight.
A thing of being straight or being not straight. It's just, you just do whatever you have to do.
Care about what, you know, the straight people, what they're going to think, man. Like, then you're not in your bag. Do you care? Do you really care?
Yeah, I care. I mean, I guess it's because I'm just starting out.
Well, it takes time. Yeah. Well, how long have you been, you know, really into it?
Well, just a couple of weeks, like I said. You know.
Did you ever have that feeling? You get into it because, why did you get into it, first of all? Why did you even start?
To make bread. I came to this city and...
But like you can make.
How much money do you make a week?
I can make close to 150, 175, 185. You know, if you want to do it every day, four times a day, you can make an awful lot of bread. You have to do. You don't have to follow everybody. You know, do more or less what you want to do. And what you like to do is make bread, right? Make it fast.
Yeah, right.
So the easiest way to do it is, you know, what you're doing here, looking for those dirty old men as they walk by, right?
How much do you get on one job?
Well, I got the stuff. Well, you know, one job, you
that's crazy.
Oh, well, everybody's a little crazy.
This is super interesting.
What about that guy over there? Do you think I could get a job with him?
See, now, look at he's
like a pig.
He's got all right, people dress sporty, right? They wear sports clothes, but, like, you don't wear a dirty T-shirt.
Oh, well.
I mean, look at this one over here.
They're like these jump cuts where it looks like the film has run out and started over.
I know. See, but you don't worry about it. It's only going to be us men and stuff and then like, fuck that scene.
But how do you know it's got any...
It reminds me a little bit of Kids, the...
Yeah.
Rosario Dawson movie. Like, the Larry Clark has, like, kind of a similar vibe, which, like, it has also similar subject matter. But, yeah, it's super evocative of, like, this era of cinema and the generation after, like, in the 90s.
Okay, this is from The Guardian. A teenage delinquent, he ran away from a rehabilitation center and found his way to the Warhol set via nude modeling and short films. Unlike Reed's other characters, he crossed over to the mainstream, becoming a magazine cover star and acting in the kind of films that get shown in multiplexes. His greatest presence in popular culture these days come from two photos. One, though, this is Lindsay talking, has an asterisk. His crotch on the cover of Rolling Stone's Sticky Fingers and his
head. Oh, that's him?
And torso on the cover of the Smiths' first album. Well, that cover has been disputed by Warhol's inner circle. So here's the Sticky Fingers.
Which one?
Cover.
The Sticky Fingers or the...
Yeah. The okay. Smiths is not disputed.
So this is from a New York Post article called Whose Crotch Is It Anyway? I have this record. I have the original version with the actual zipper that goes up and down.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So Glenn O'Brien was the editor of Warhol's Interview magazine, and he said that Warhol photographed several men for the cover, and he never told anyone the identity of the cover model. O'Brien thinks it's possible he doesn't even know. Quote O'Brien, he probably took these Polaroids, put them on the table, and picked one he liked. I don't think it mattered to him who it was. So O'Brien was in a later pick.
Like from the inside or something?
Yeah. And he said, I don't know if the fact that I was chosen means I was the best endowed or what. As for the jeans pick, O'Brien believes it was Corey Tippin, a makeup artist who was part of the Warhol scene. Tippin didn't know what the shoot was for and received only $75.
He's like, I'd know that Dick Bulge anywhere.
Tippin said, I knew Warhol wanted it to be kind of an erotic photo. Andy wanted a bulgy crotch, Tippin said. To me, it had nothing to do with rock and roll. Those of us in the gay world related to it as a gay iconic image. Tippin was also never told the identity of the jeans model on the cover, but he says it's him. Quote, I know my anatomy.
Ah, so everyone's volunteer. It's a real I Am Spartacus moment, just with
for
like
sure.
A giant cock in a, yeah. In a pair of jeans. I mean, I think that that's interesting. I also think that like we talk about like the objectification and sexualization of women a lot on this show, and it's interesting that when the album cover does that to a man, it becomes this icon of gay culture, because like it's so rare to objectify a man, at least, especially at this time, it's so rare to objectify a man on like a Rolling Stones album cover. You get it? Like the biggest band in the world.
Yeah,
doesn't get any more straight than the Rolling Stones. You can take that to the bank.
All right. Okay, so that was Joe.
That was Joe. Next up is Sugar Plum Fairy. So Sugar Plum came and hit the streets looking for soul food and a place to eat. Racism, but this means that she is black, right? And if you weren't certain, the next line is, went to the Apollo. Should have seen them go, go, go. So the Apollo is a very famous theater in Harlem that was where black artists would perform. Showtime at the Apollo.
Everything you're saying is true.
Sick.
However, popular belief is that Sugar Plum Fairy is a reference to actor Joe Campbell, who played a character by that name in Warhol's 1965 film, My Hustler.
So not...
Hold that thought, though. Because this person, Joe Campbell... prior to joining the Warhol crowd, was Harvey Milk's partner for approximately 6 years.
Yeah, so I believe that this is... So this guy is white, the Joe Campbell, the Warhol superstar. Weird. Then all of my assessments...
We're racist.
Well, I mean, I'm just reading the tea leaves here, my friend. Like, it's interesting that that you'd say this about a white dude.
And then I will also say, I read something in my research that said there's some kind of urban legend that there was two Sugar Plum Fairies. Mm. And so perhaps the one who really stuck as, like, if you Google who is Sugar Plum Fairy in Walk on the Wild Side, you will get Joe Campbell as your, like, top result. However, it might not be true.
Yeah, interesting. Insane that you would say this about a white dude, but that's why Lou Reed's the greatest, I guess.
I mean, now I'm like very curious. I'm like, I wonder if this like Sugar Plum Fairy, because Sugar Plum Fairy was the euphemism for a drug dealer. And so maybe there was a Sugar Plum Fairy drug dealer who was not Joe Campbell, but Joe Campbell played a character named Sugar Plum Fairy in a Warhol film.
Very interesting.
Unsolved.
Unsolved.
All right. And now we get to Jackie.
Jackie was just fading away.
Speeding
away. Thought she was James Dean for a day. This feels like a play on words with speed, like James Dean died in a car crash, but also mm-hmm. speed, like I'm doing a lot of drugs. Mm-hmm. Because Valium could have helped that. Bash?
I just don't feel like Bash is the correct
word. I don't think Bash is right either, but that's what it says here. But Valium is like a drug that chills you out. And so it seems like she took too much speed and nearly crashed, figuratively or literally.
So we heard Holly talking about Jackie.
Jackie, like, bailing her out of prison, ripping her dress and going to see the movie Trash.
Yes. And she sometimes performed as a woman, sometimes as a man.
Ooh.
And her glitter and lipstick style was claimed to have been an inspiration to the glam rock movement.
I'm sure it was. There's an interesting, I worked as an editor for a docu-series about the history of, like, street dance, specifically when we were looking at Holly and Candy. They took a lot from, like, the glamour girls of the 50s and 60s, and there's this dude named Victor Manuel who was one of the originators of a dance called punking. It's also sometimes is referred to as whacking or voguing, right? And yeah, so what he says in this documentary, which isn't out yet, but it's free information, this isn't a big reveal, is that the punking and the whacking and the voguing came about because the queer dance scene in New York were posing like the glamour girls in the pinups of the 50s and 60s. So, like, the posing is like, imagine, you know, Greta Garbo with her hands like here, and they're doing like pose, 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 pose. And even in Madonna's Vogue, the song, she like name checks all of those mm-hmm. old glamour girls. And so that's where all these dance crazes come from, is like gay culture taking these pictures that they'd seen in magazines and like posing them on the dance floor, which I find super interesting.
Yeah.
And like, it's kind of contemporary, a little after this era, but like pretty contemporary to it. Like late 70s, early 80s.
Jackie wrote musicals and poetry and sang, and her 1967 play, Glory, Glamour, and Gold, gave Robert De Niro his first stage role.
Fuck yeah. Good job, Jackie.
So Craig Heiberger made the documentary The Superstar in a House Dress, which we saw the clip earlier. Mm-hmm. He recalled Curtis bringing home a sailor one night. Quote, his lipstick was smeared all over the sailor's mouth and neck. We deposited him on the sofa and Curtis came to the kitchen with me to get some beers and whispered, Craig, he thinks I'm a real girl. What am I going to do when he finds out I'm not? Curtis died of a heroin overdose in 1985 at age 38.
Jeez. I mean, really incredibly, like, these people like lived out loud pretty hardcore, and it's a shame that they died of sometimes very preventable things way too early. They could have given us more. They could have lived happy, healthy lives and shared more art with the world.
If the world had been more accepting of them and they didn't feel like they had to self-medicate.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that you were saying about Holly, right? Holly was like, should have been worrying about trigonometry and instead was like turning tricks for a place to eat. And it's not, correlation doesn't necessarily equal causation, but like if her life was more accepting and she didn't have to become a homeless teenager, maybe she, and could have lived the life that she thought was authentic to her, like she wouldn't have had to turn these tricks. And she wouldn't have had this, like, you know, harrowing thing to go through. Yeah, really, really sad that we are pushing people to this even to this day.
Okay, so Jackie starred in Flesh as well.
Mm-hmm.
and Women in Revolt, and allegedly harnessed a deep obsession with James Dean.
There you go.
And as you alluded to, the speeding and the crash were play on words referencing to James Dean, but also drugs.
And James Dean is an interesting character who, like, people upon reappraisal think that he may have not been all the way straight. And it's also interesting to me that Jackie played both sides of the gender coin, right? They mention him as a, they use like male masculine pronouns for him. So it's interesting that he can be both James Dean and the object of James Dean's affection in the movies at the same time.
And Jackie described themselves as not a boy, not a girl, not a F slur, not a drag queen, not a transsexual. I'm just me, Jackie.
I think we would probably use the term intersex at this, in this day and age, or maybe just non-binary. Yeah. Right on, Jackie.
I'm just me, Jackie. I love that.
Yeah. Just Jackie.
Right? Here's Jackie Curtis in an autobiographical sketch from 1983, and this is coming to us from documentarian Craig Heiberger.
Right, who did the other doc?
Yeah, who did the hairdresser one, or house dress.
Hairdresser and a house dresser.
And now, children, before you all turn in, at the beginning of this book, there's a bio, and it's mine, so I thought I'd... pass it on.
So this is the bio that was written for a collection of Curtis's poems,
I shall read from
Wild
the page.
Orchids, and now they're performing it.
Jackie Curtis. Bio. When I was a student in paradoxology at the University of Spirit Lake in Washington, my professor told me that my mission in life was to see through the veneer of ambiguity, enigma, language, mathematics, science, and existence. To this end, I have traveled around the world collecting serious and whimsical puzzles.
Yeah, I don't know. It reminds me of so many of these like cool experimental documentaries that I've seen. This one specifically reminds me of a movie called Tarnation, which came out in 2003.
Carnation or Tarnation?
Tarnation with a T. Which is very good and very sad. Really sad that they all left us too early.
Most. I think Joe's still alive.
Oh, that's nice.
So we're coming closer to the end, but I want to hear from the superstars and what, specifically Holly, and what they think of Wild Side Song.
Oh, yeah.
And so this video is coming from YouTube channel called Gary Sunday.
My name is Hollywood Lawn, and yes, that song is completely true about me hitchhiking from Miami. At the age of 15 and a half of my dad, which is not easy, in 1963, poor boy. And I plucked, well, actually, I don't know which I did first, which was I think I plucked my eyebrows first and then shaved my legs. I don't know how to pluck your eyebrows along and shave the legs. Hey, yeah, the song's right. Plucked her rabbis along the way, shaved her legs, and then he was she. Yes, the song's right. Jackie Curtis was like the snappy redhead, you know, real, you know, smart one. Candy was Jean Harlow. blonde. And I was the brunette.
Had a real Charlie's Angels thing going.
In the beginning, we were all friends, like in the early 60s. And when we all, you know, this is before any of the Warhol stuff. We were really like close sisters. We were not like Lana Turner or Jean Harlow or Hedy Lamarr, which is what we wanted to be or who we thought we were in our drug-crazed minds. In our minds, we were women, but what we looked like was another story.
They were real lowlife. It was. The song is true. They really were on the wild side. Candy Darling really did give head on the roof of buildings
okay.
at 4 o'clock in the morning to sailors who didn't know she wasn't a woman. You know, Jackie Curtis really was putting speed in her coffee first thing when she woke up in the morning and absolutely had no idea that her beard was coming through her makeup because she couldn't even see her face. You know, Hollywood Lawn really was laying in the gutter and asking other bums to help her.
It's not in the song.
I think that basically Andy just loved
is there
glamorous
cut
women.
Verses?
And around that time, he just didn't know any.
Candy tricked Jackie into putting on her first dress and said things like, "Oh, yes, Jackie, you look just like a woman." And of course, she didn't and never did. But she turned it into her own trip. And Andy would say, "Oh, but Jackie's so fabulous. Look at Jackie." And of course, it worked.
When Hollywood Lawn came along, she was very trashy. She'd take her clothes out of garbage bins. She was like drink and scream and roll around on the floor and throw her things, pull her dresses up in the air. And Warhol was absolutely fascinated with Hollywood Lawn. And Jackie and Candy were like, he's liking her now, you know. They were like livid.
Lights, cameras, action. There was two little lights and one camera and Paul behind the camera. And then, of course, the set was, this is a little bit cleaner, but it was a dump, and there was Joe, my big co-star, sweeping.
I just happened to be in the same building that they were shooting something in, and friends of mine said, "Oh, Andy Warhol's downstairs shooting a movie," and I said, "Who's Andy Warhol?" And they told me this famous artist, and we went down there to watch, and Paul came out from standing behind the camera with Andy and asked me to do a small scene. And Andy sat behind the camera with his reading. He would always read a newspaper while he sat behind the camera, and all he did was click the camera on and off. That was it.
It was really weird. It was really strange to see all those people just like hitting in my direct after I just left jail. Mobs of people going, and all they wanted was my autograph. I signed my first autograph that night. I was, when I saw my name in lights, it was like so, it was like everything I had ever lived for.
All right, thoughts?
Thoughts. I mean, I think I said them, but I'll reiterate. It's interesting that I have a new appraisal of this 15 minutes of fame quote. And I had never realized that how insanely true the Walk on the Wild Side plot or vignettes were, so much so that Hollywood Lawn is like, "Oh yeah, I did pluck my eyebrows before I shaved my legs."
Like, very okay. specific.
Yeah, super specific. I don't know if that's like, I don't know if that was necessarily intended. It's just like a syllable thing. But like, yeah, all these people are real and existed and gave us their own art other than just the art that was inspired by them, like Lou's song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Walk on the Wild Side peaked at number 16 on the Billboard Hot 100 singles chart. In 2010, it made it to number 223 on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time.
I think that's a fair appraisal.
What I love about this song that I didn't know, which is what you were saying as well, is how Reed gave a voice to these people who were sort of outcast from mainstream society and immortalized them forever in a mainstream song.
And Lola is even bigger. And the fact that it's like Lola and Candy is Lola and is... in this song is like gargantuan.
We'll have to do a little.
Yeah, we'll have to do a... Spoilers, it's about Candy Darling.
Sadly, Lou Reed died from liver disease in October on Aviv's birthday of 2013.
Yeah, my birthday of 2013.
This is from his New York Times obituary. Mr. Reed brought dark themes and a mercurial, sometimes aggressive disposition to rock music. Quote, I've always believed that there's an amazing number of things you can do through rock and roll, he said to journalist Christine McKenna, and that you could do serious writing in a rock song if you can somehow do it without losing the beat. The things I've written about wouldn't be considered a big deal if they appeared in a book or a movie.
You can do serious writing in a rock song as long as you don't lose the beat is the new thing I'm going to live by.
Yes.
I think that that's like exactly how I feel about rock and roll music.
You're welcome for your new
Thank you. Jeez. That was great.
So the Velvet Underground, which was originally sponsored by Andy Warhol, this is still the New York Times, and showcased the songwriting of John Cale as well as Reed, wrought gradual but profound impact on the high IQ, low virtuosity stratum of punk, alternative, and underground rock around the world. Joy Division, Talking Heads, Patti Smith, R.E.M., The Strokes, and numerous others were descendants. The composer Brian Eno, in an often quoted interview from 1982, suggested that if the group's first album, The Velvet Underground and Nico, sold only 30,000 copies during its first 5 years, a figure probably lower in reality, quote, everyone who bought one of those 30,000 copies started a band.
Yeah. Brian Eno is also one of my musical heroes. So I've remembered that it was Brian Eno just a little too late.
He did that album with
David Byrne. Everything that happens will happen today, which is really, really great. Brian Eno also did the Windows sounds. All of the Windows sounds, I think, were Brian Eno.
All the Windows sounds.
I name checked Brian Eno in one of my songs, actually.
Do you know?
Yeah, I wrote a song called Totally Depressed, and I long for the apocalypse to come and take us all. And when I say take us all, I mean take us all. You, me, Brian Eno, and Mark Mothersbaugh. Yeah.
Well, and MGMT has a song called Brian Eno.
Brian Eno?
We haven't talked about MGMT because I kind of forgot they existed.
Yeah, they're boring as hell. I think I've told this story before to you, maybe privately, but I saw MGMT in 2008 and they were so boring that I forgot. And so when they became famous in like 2009, I was like, oh, this band sucks. And my girlfriend at the time was like, you know, we saw them. I was like, no, I did not remember that.
And I didn't remember they existed. I was like, who did that Brian Eno song? Oh, MGMT.
Is that what we're going out on this week?
No.
Oh, thank you for not making me listen to MGMT.
But that wasn't the plan. Back to New York Times. Many of the group's themes, among them love, sexual deviance, alienation, addiction, joy, and spiritual transfiguration, stayed in Mr. Reed's work through his long run of solo recordings. Among the most noteworthy of those recordings were Transformer, 1972. That's what gave us Walk on the Wild Side. Mm-hmm. Berlin, 1973. And New York, 1989. The most notorious, without question, was Metal Machine Music, 1975.
Yes. And I believe that record got a Tipper Gore, like
this parental is bad.
Advisory thing. But it's also just an instrumental album. I don't think there are any lyrics on it.
This will brainwash your children.
Yeah.
The devil sounds.
That's the story. Metal Machine Music, I believe, is just instrumental.
But it was called metal, so
Tipper. So they're like, absolutely not.
Reed confidently made artistic decisions that other musicians would not have even considered. He was an aesthetic primitivist with high-end audio obsessions. He was an English major who understood his work as a form of literature, though he distrusted overly poetic pop lyrics, and though distorted electric guitars and drums sometimes drowned out his words.
Man, Lou Reed was the fucking best. That rips. I also think it's cool that, like, for most of, at least most of his most famous songs, it sounds like he can't be bothered to raise his voice. He's just like chilling there. He's probably sitting. And I like really respect that you can like command a rock and roll song while being like super fucking laid back.
So underwhelmed.
Yeah, right. No, this is what life is miserable.
So what are we going out on today?
It better not be MGMT.
It's not. I don't know if you're going to like it anymore.
Hmm. Lou Reed did a cool song with the Killers.
Really?
Sawdust album, yeah.
I love the Killers. Wonder if I know the song, and I just don't know I know it.
Can't remember what it's called right now, but it's very, very good. Don't stop dragging me down. All right, Lou Reed's All-Star Band of Comics. Walk on the Wild Side. Night of Too Many Stars. Oh, this is the Jon Stewart thing? I don't remember. I think Night of Too Many Stars...
Let's try.
Yeah. Adam Sandler, Jack Black, Dana Carvey, Jimmy Fallon, and Conan O'Brien for autism research.
Was hosted by Jon Stewart.
Oh, I knew it. Yeah, nailed it. By the way, because this is for autism research, this is my opportunity to say, do not vote for RFK Jr. He is a crackpot. Vaccines do not cause autism. Go fuck yourself.
Well, it's been an amazing night, but I've got one more big surprise. I can't believe this is happening.
I love these benefit
shows. They like to end with a big all-star jam. And tonight, we think we put together the most ass-kicking, greatest all-star band in history.
Okay.
Yeah. Here we go.
It's just all of Led Zeppelin.
Vocals, Mr. Lou Reed.
He also was like punk until the day he died. Yeah. He's wearing leather pants. He's like fucking 80.
Also on guitar. Also on guitar to keep this band cooking, Mr. Conan O'Brien.
Conan's guitar is not plugged in.
On the drums, the one and only Mr. Dana Carvey, everybody. Guitar and vocals, courtesy of the legendary Mr. Adam Sandler!
Sandler looks exactly the same, too. Lou Reed is not high-fiving anybody. I love it.
I know.
Look at him. Get fucked. Mr. Jack Black is here!
And also, on rhythm guitar, Mr. Jimmy Fallon!
Someone's got to play the bass, you guys. The bass is so iconic in the song. What the fuck are you doing?
It's gonna be awesome, man.
Five guitars, no bass.
You okay? You all right?
Yeah, this is great.
What's the matter, buddy?
Well, you said there'd be some real musicians here, man. What
do you mean? Like who? What are you talking about? Who? What?
You're comedian.
Like, what do you mean, dude?
Where's Eric?
Yeah, dude, you don't.
Where's Carlos?
No.
I can't believe I'm hearing this. You don't think we're real musicians?
You don't think we can handle Take a Walk on the Wild Side? Is that what you're about?
Yeah. Why don't we find out, Jack?
Can people find us on the internet?
Just find us on the internet at lyricsforlunch.com and on Instagram and Twitter at lyricsforlunch.
For longer and weirder stuff, send us an email at lyricsforlunch@gmail.com.
Yeah, tell your friends about us, tell your enemies about us, tell all of your hustler friends about us, your sugar plum fairies and whatnot.
And if you want to support the show, go to lyricsforlunch.com and click support the show.
And tune in next week when we do this all over again with another song about turning tricks.
Whoop whoop.
Until then, I'm Aviv Rubenstein.
I'm Lindsay Tucker.
Saying, hey babe.
Hey babe.
Go walk on the wild side.
In the back room, she was everybody's darling.
but she never lost her head. Even when an